A very good morning. Welcome to This Is Money in Share Radio podcast. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Every weekday from 9 until 1, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lavett and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their website that they've been investigating over the past 7 days. And on the agenda today, named and shamed. The banks paying frankly pathetic rates of return to often their most loyal savers. They're exposed as the city watchdog cracks down on opacity and obfuscation.
There's a lot of people I'm talking to at the moment who are absolutely fed up with cash. They're getting very little back from their savings accounts or their cash ISAs.
It comes as the Bank of England poured more cold water over savers, deciding to hold interest rates at that record 0.5% low.
The 81st consecutive month now that interest rates have remained unchanged. And I think given what's happening in oil prices, given some mixed signs in the economy, it wasn't surprising though.
Well, talking about oil prices, what on earth is going on here? Could the price of Brent crude really drop to $20 a barrel? Good news, I suppose, at the pumps. Could we soon see thousands of new family homes built on green belt land in what would be the biggest shake-up of planning rules for 3 decades? Also coming up, it's been revealed we're overpaying our energy bills to the tune of £6.5 billion in the last 12 months. Would stuffing your freezer with old newspapers help? I don't know. We'll let you know. But switching might.
More scope for things to go wrong when you switch bank accounts, although it's much better than it used to be. But actually, with energy, it really should be fine. It should be a pretty much a painless process.
The best and worst performing fund managers of the year have been revealed. Simon will let us know the wheat from the chaff on this. And talking of investing, would you opt for a £6,000 bottle of single malt? We look at how to start whiskey investing and making sure your returns don't go sour. But on that theme, expensive beverages I'm talking about. I want to know, what is the most expensive food or drink item you have tried for what it was? So, for example, you went to a service station and paid £15 for a bottle of water or something. A very good morning, Simon. I'll start with you. The most expensive food item or drink item?
Good morning. The most expensive food or drink item I've ever had, I reckon, is a humble bottle of water, which is embarrassing, really, because I hate paying for bottles of water. I'm definitely a drink-it-from-the-tap kind of man.
In a glass?
In a
first.
Glass.
Okay,
yeah,
right, just
well,
that.
I don't know.
I had images there.
Depends how thirsty you are, doesn't
it? That's a good point.
You know, when you're staying in a hotel, though, there's always that question, is the water from the tap in the bathroom okay to drink? Mm. And you hear a lot of bad stories about people getting ill in hotels from the water, don't you? So I'm always a bit wary of that. So I reckon it's probably a bottle of water in a hotel, and I think I paid £6 for the bottle of water.
Ooh.
And hoteliers of the world, let me tell you something. If I have paid you money to stay in your hotel, and in fact, if I'm staying in your hotel and it's an expensive hotel, stop ripping me off for everything. One of the privileges of paying money to stay in a hotel should be to not be ripped off. Don't think that people want to pay to stay in your hotel and then rip them off for everything. So if you've ever charged £5 for a bottle of water, hang your head in shame.
You know, Simon, you could have just walked out of said hotel room. Normally there's shops
no,
around.
There was no shop option. I don't know. It was the shops were
nowhere.
Shut. Not in London, basically. It's great in London. You can buy stuff at any time of the day or night, can't you? And then you go outside of London and you get a shock.
Was there a point at which, though, Simon, I really want to know, you would have actually drunk from the tap? Would it? I'm thinking £10, £15. At which point would you have gone, nah, my health over my wallet?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. There definitely is. But I think I was in a foreign country, so it was Monopoly money, wasn't it?
You should have put the water in the kettle, that tap water in the kettle, boiled it and wait for it to cool down. You know.
Oh, that's absolutely perfect. That's exactly what you want before you go to sleep, isn't it?
No one likes a clever sound.
I think I can beat that for water. I remember being in a nightclub in Ibiza, where water was more expensive than beer for some bizarre reason.
Look at you two,
about 15, about 15 quid or something.
I think
for
I
a
remember
bottle.
Being in
crazy.
A nightclub in Leeds where water was more expensive than beer, but I think that reflected the price of the beer.
Yeah, well, yeah, I just remember it being like, you know, 15 quid or something for water, and I was just really thirsty. It was like, I was a university student. I was like, do I really want to spend? Nah, just get another beer. Goodness. It's mainly water anyway. So I think that probably is, if you look at it by sort of like amount, probably was the most expensive thing
for
I've ever
what
drunk.
It was. Yeah. Oh, look at you two party animals with your water there. For me, I think for what it was £17 for a pint of beer in Norway, but for the most expensive, £100 for a little glass of sherry.
Was it good sherry, though?
Well, it was all right, Lee. Yeah. I'm not going to... It was okay, you know.
Good enough to cook with?
Yeah.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio on Digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio for our weekly catch-up. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, oil drops, rates stick, greenbelt twists. But first, the woes of savers have been thrown into sharp relief this week. In a victory for This Is Money, the city watchdog is vowing to get tough on those banks offering paltry rates of return, with a number paying just 0.01% named and shamed. Then, and no shocks here, the Bank of England, meeting for the final time this year, decided to leave the base rate of interest at that record low, where it's languished at 0.5% since March 2009. Well, Lloyds Bank's Adam Chester spoke to Share Radio.
It's pretty much universally expected. I think no change this month. The 81st consecutive month now that interest rates have remained unchanged. And I think given what's happening in oil prices, given some mixed signs in the economy, it wasn't surprising, though. We think sort of bank rate, base rate will start heading higher over the course of 2016, albeit very gradually. We expect around the spring or summer of next year that inflation in the United Kingdom will have moved off its lows, partly because the exceptional weakness we've seen in energy prices, petrol prices, heating oil, gas, etc., will start to dissipate over the course, I think, of next year. And that will start to drive headline inflation up a little bit. And I think that will be the key catalyst for the Bank of England. I think growth conditions in the United Kingdom at the moment aren't too bad. The economy is growing at around 2 to 2.5%, which is broad in line with its long-term average. I think the missing ingredient to a rise in interest rates, obviously, is the weakness of inflation at the moment.
So that was Lloyds Bank's Adam Chester speaking to us a little bit earlier. So, Simon, no surprises, I guess. What were the reasons given?
For holding interest rates, we're just not ready for them to go up yet, basically. Well, if you look at the situation that the UK economy is in, we have no inflation. In fact, we have a slight bout of deflation. There is concern that the economy growth, although reasonable, isn't that great and it might be slowing slightly. There are concerns, especially surrounding manufacturing and also concerns surrounding exports. So actually, the Bank of England is looking at this and going, well, we don't think we're ready to raise rates yet. Now, what makes this particularly interesting is that at one point, it was decided that it was odds on that interest rates would have gone up this year. In case anyone hasn't noticed, it is December. That is the final rate-setting meeting of the year. And so we have just marked another year with interest rates at 0.5%. But to look at the bigger picture, there is a place in the world where they might be putting up interest rates, and it's quite an important place.
Well, let's
and
look
it's the Fed.
Exactly. Let's look at the bigger picture, because you've got very varying pictures as we look at the US, the UK and the EU as well. But let's head over the pond, shall we? What's going on in the US?
Well, in the US, people have decided that the US were probably going to put up interest rates in summer this year. And then that didn't happen. And then they said September, and everyone thought September was going to happen. And then they didn't do September because the markets fell out of bed in August. There was a big slump. And now it's December. And it's got to the point now where at the start of the year, everyone was talking about interest rates and interest rate rise being feared. Now that interest rate rise in the States is being hoped for. So if they do not raise interest rates next week, next Wednesday, then that will actually be a surprise. And the markets will then probably decide to fall out of bed for the opposite reason that they would have fallen out of bed at the start of the year.
So I thought traditionally, though, the Bank of England followed where the Fed led. Are we seeing a conscious uncoupling of the two, perhaps, here?
Yes, we are. It's sad, isn't it? It's sad. It's just like Gwyneth and Chris.
Exactly, yeah. Isn't it?
He says, desperately trying to remember the Coldplay singer's name.
Well done, yeah. Chris Martin.
No, I think the big talk at the moment in economic circles and in sort of market circles is of this divergence. And the divergence they're talking about is the split between the Fed and the US, where the US path for interest rates is looking at, and Europe. And so in Europe, you've got the ECB, the European Central Bank, cutting interest rates further into negative territory and talking about doing more quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. And in the US, you've got them talking about raising rates. And so Britain, well, where do we sit in that? I mean, people would think that we sit closer to the States, but actually I'm not so sure that we don't sit a little bit closer to Europe than we think. Obviously, we don't have the problems of the euro, but the eurozone is our major trading partner. And the big issue, if we start raising interest rates, is that the pound is going to appreciate. And the pound appreciating against the euro is not particularly great news for the British economy in terms of our trade, because it will cost a lot more for people in Europe to buy our goods. Look, my personal view is that we should raise interest rates. I think that we've got to the point now where interest rates are 0.5% for the amount of time they've been there. I think it's 82 months now, which is an exceptional amount of time. I think it's just become counterproductive. And I think that we do need to get ourselves off the floor. And I don't think having them down there or keeping them down there is necessarily doing the economy any good. But the Bank of England is really concerned about putting them up too soon or putting them up too fast. It's not really the first one. It's the ones after that.
Yeah.
And knocking the recovery on the head. And they don't want to be, what they really don't want to be seen to be doing is putting rates up and then going, oh, we were wrong, and putting them straight back down.
But Simon, wasn't the point of having rates this low to stimulate the economy when there was a crash at hand? What left is there should we face another really big, serious problem?
Well, there isn't. There's not a lot less. So more quantitative easing, or the so-called helicopter drop of money, where you just put some money into people's bank accounts randomly and get them to spend it. I mean, the winner from this, you asked before, the winners and losers, the winners have been borrowers. So anybody borrowing money, it's been very cheap to borrow money. But arguably, that means that too much money is flowing into the wrong things. The property market, maybe we're buying far too many new cars that we can't really afford. Yeah. And maybe we're putting too much money on the credit cards and stuff like that. But you've got this paradox, haven't you, where basically in order to try and get out of a financial crisis brought about by debt, you need to encourage people to take on some more debt and spend some money.
Now, David Kern, the chief economist at the British Chambers of Commerce, suggesting any rate increase will be in the third quarter of 2016 at the earliest. We're going to play our favourite game of Guess the Rate Rise Bingo. And Simon, for you?
May. As long as something bad doesn't happen before May.
2020. No, I think it'll be sort of August time.
What's your views about all of this?
I think that Simon's right. I think interest rates do need to start coming up now. There's been so much chat about it for a long time. I almost feel like people in Britain, even a man on the street, has a bit of knowledge, you know, about what it all means for the pound in their pocket now. And they're kind of accepting of the fact that, you know, interest rates are going to come up at some point. I just think they're delaying it for too long. And you look at how the voting's going on these things. I mean, it's completely overwhelming. They're keeping it held. And it's just, you know, the question is, when will they do it? And I think it's important that they start to rise fairly soon. And if the US do it next week, you know, it sort of sets a precedent, doesn't it?
And if nothing else, to give savers a bit of a boost. It's been a bit of a rough time for them. But we did hear some better news this week after a pretty long campaign by yourselves. The City Watchdog has started to name and shame those banks paying rubbish returns to their customers, often the most loyal. Rates we're seeing as low as 0.01%. The Financial Conduct Authority has promised to publish these reports every 6 months and announced a number of other moves to make banking more transparent. Well, earlier I spoke to finance expert Holly Mackay, founder of Boring Money.
There's a lot of people I'm talking to at the moment who are absolutely fed up with cash. They're getting very little back from their savings accounts or their cash ISAs. I think you look at that pot of money, and if there's some of it which you think you can safely put away for at least 5 years, then it's worth thinking about the stock market. If you're nervous about the stock market and a newcomer, I'd suggest go and have a look at Fidelity's website or Hargreaves Lansdown, and they have sort of, they'll handhold you through the process, and it's worth a look.
Well, that was finance expert Holly Mackay, founder of boringmoney.co.uk. Now, before we hear I think we can call it a partial confession from Simon Lee, I want you to tell us who's been named and shamed, please.
Oh, there's all sorts of banks and builder societies that are paying an absolute pittance. You know, some real big high street names. First Direct came up on the reporters paying an account with 0%. So it's doing nothing. So, you know, this FCA report, it's one of those things that feels like it just rumbles on forever and ever. And the FCA is always doing a report into savings and why savings rates are so low. And nothing actually ever really happens. And I don't know if I'm imagining this, but I'm sure there's been a naming and shaming thing in the past with these savings rates. So what they're going to do is just publish a list every 6 months showing where the rates are going down, you know, where the rates are the lowest. And what's that going to make banks, building societies do? I don't know. But
they're calling it sunlight remedy.
Oh, God. I mean, please, stop it. I mean, it's the fact of the matter is, and what this report highlights, is that there's £160 billion of deposits that are earning 0.5% or more, in savings accounts that are earning 0.5% or more, or less, sorry. And, you know, a lot of these accounts pay 0.1%, you know, these legacy accounts, and people have money in them. I just, you know, really want people just to have a look if they've got savings. You know, a lot of people open a lot of savings accounts over the years and might lose track of their rates, and this is another thing this FCA report is looking to tackle, and this is something that we've campaigned on for a long time.
Yeah, tell us about this. Your online rate honesty campaign has been going for a while.
It has. We started up almost 5 years ago now, and it was just a call to make banks, building societies, simply just put the rate of interest that you were earning on your savings account, you know, really clearly transparent without having to dig around. What you have to do is sort of dig through loads of old accounts to see, you know, I was Easy Access Saver version 7, you know, and then you, oh, well, the rate's gone down. And it was really confusing. It was quite annoying because you might have taken out an account that was paying, let's say, 2% back, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and it had a 12-month bonus, and that bonus drops off, and then you've forgotten about it. But of course, if you're checking your savings online and your rate's not coming up at the top of your statement, then you've probably forgotten about it. So this campaign that we had, we just wanted banks, builder size, simply to make that change. Some of them stepped up to the plate and actually did make the change.
Yeah, Nationwide, wasn't it?
Yeah, Nationwide, I think. There's a few others that definitely do it. Halifax definitely do it. There's a few that do it. But in this day and age, if there's still banks and building societies that are not doing that and are having to get forced from the FCA to do it, I just think it's an absolute joke. And it actually it's really quite annoying.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a raft of measures, though. They're introducing text message alerts to remind you when an introductory bonus rate is due to end. However, teaser rates are here to stay. No hint there that we're going to get rid of those.
But they've really have fallen off a cliff. There's not many accounts now. The main focus of savings rates in the last 2 years has been fixed rate accounts. Now, fixed rate doesn't obviously have a bonus on it, so that's where the majority of people are now opening accounts. Easy access-wise, the rates have fallen so far, people have just got fed up with them and moved over to current accounts that pay interest. That seems to be, you know, the real trend of what's happening. So these teaser accounts are one of these things that they kind of talked about a couple of years ago and perhaps getting rid of them. But they're so few and far between now anyway that, you know, these teaser rates tend to not really stick around. It's more of a case of people just having variable rates that just go down and not realising it.
Now, Christopher Woollard, Director of Strategy and Competition at the FCA, said, with many savers never switching because they don't think it'll make a difference, our rules will help consumers get the information they need to shop around. In a good market, providers should be competing to offer the best possible deal, and should a consumer wish to move accounts, they should be able to do so with the minimum of fuss. But it also found 80% of Easy Access accounts had not been switched in the last 3 years. Lee, is it hard to do?
I don't think it's that hard to do, but I think if you give people confidence like they've had with the current account switching service, for example, the 7-day switch, if you start putting those guarantees on people that, you know, they'll close an account and move it into another account, it should be, in theory, it should be far simpler than a current account where you've got to move direct debits, you've got to move other payments, your wages, all those sort of things. So I think if you start putting those guarantees on, people might be, you know, more encouraged to do it. But I think the long and short of it, people would be more encouraged to do it if there was actually attractive rates out there to switch to in the
absolutely.
First place.
Simon, I'm going to get on to you in a moment, your partial confession. But one final thing, you do produce independent saving tables if people do want to find out what the best rates are out there. Tell us how these are compiled, Lee, if you would, and how independent they really are, just to put our minds at ease.
It's completely independent, yeah. So we don't ever put any, we just list, basically, such a simple list of just the top paying accounts that are currently out there that are open to everyone. Sylvia Morris, who's a saving expert over in the Daily Mail, Money Mail, compiles them for us throughout the week, and they're always up to date. And if you want to maximise the returns you're getting on your cash, check out those tables.
Thank you very much.
co.uk/save.
So, Simon, have you memorised that for a reason? Because you have an account that pays 0.05%.
Yes.
But it's the best one you could have? Explain.
My name is Simon Lambert, and I have a savings account that pays 0.05%.
Welcome to the Consumer Issue Studio. Continue.
Thank you very much. It's with First Direct. And I must admit that until...
The fans' favourite,
yes. And it was what alerted me to how low the rate may possibly be was the fact that in this report it was revealed that First Direct had an account that paid nothing. And I thought, ooh, I wonder if I've got that one. So I checked.
And you went, phew!
I checked and I discovered that actually, no, I didn't have that one. I've not got one that's that bad. I've got one that pays 0.05%. In fact, I've got three of them.
Three?
Three. Three of these. I like it so much I've got three of them.
Okay.
But there is a twist in this tale. Basically, these are the savings accounts that First Direct allows me to link to my mortgage, which is an offset mortgage. And the way an offset mortgage works is that you set your savings or your current account balance against your mortgage and you only pay interest on the gap in the middle, on the balance in between. And that effectively means that the savings rate that you're getting on your mortgage, the savings rate that you are getting is the equivalent of the interest rate on your mortgage. The interest rate on my mortgage is 2.75%. So I'm effectively getting a 2.75% return on my savings, tax-free as well. So actually, when you multiply that up by tax, then it jumps up again. So actually, this is the best savings account I could possibly have. I don't have to worry about the rate.
So nanny-nanner to you, but...
So I would say two things. One of the reasons why I like offset mortgages is because they allow you to do this thing and they play into the hands of us lazy, inertia... prone human beings who just say we're going to do something and then we don't do it. So we spend all of our time telling people to move their money to the best savings accounts. I bet you could go out there and find plenty of financial journalists who don't have their money in the best savings accounts. What this means is I don't need to worry about leaving my money in a rubbish savings account like this one or even in my current account because I'm earning a return on it. However, before this risks turning into some kind of love letter to First Direct and its wonderful offset mortgage, it does beg a question of what on earth is First Direct thinking by having a savings account that pays 0.05%? I mean, that is absolutely appalling because you can guarantee that not everybody in that savings account has an offset mortgage. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that there's loads of them who don't have it linked to their mortgage. Yeah. So all of those people are being paid
this pitiful rate
on their savings.
You've answered what they're thinking with they're behaving like a classic banking weasel, you've said here.
Weasels, yes. We identified weasels 5 years ago when we launched our online rate honesty campaign and pointed out that many banks were weasels. And they were weasels because they allow people to fall onto these legacy savings rates, knowing that they can get away with paying them less money than they should do because basically people are lazy and they won't move. And not displaying their rate is a crucial part of that because it means that people don't get alerted to their rate. And that is weaselly behaviour. And what I've said is that it's great that the FCA is cracking down on the banks and building societies, but don't expect the weasel behaviour to stop. You have to basically take responsibility for your savings yourself because your bank is not set up to make sure that you're always getting the best rate.
I do want to ask you, returning back to the Bank of England holding the base rate at 0.5%, when they do decide to raise it, how quickly does it tend to follow that savers might start feeling a bit more...
Let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, there used to be this occasion when you would have a meeting of some men and women who knew what to do with the economy at the Bank of England. And sometimes in that meeting, the interest rate would change. It could go up or it could go down.
I don't believe you, Simon.
And once upon a time, there was a website called This Is Money that used to have a thing called Has Your Mortgage Rate Changed? And Has Your Savings Rate Changed? Where we used to tell people, after these interest rates might have changed, whether their mortgage rate or savings rate had changed. But then that all stopped for 82 months in a row. Actually, they tend to move quite quickly. The mortgage rates and savings rates, it tends to happen in a few days after the rate change. And then it's a case of watching out who's raised their mortgage by the full rise, who's raised it by more, who's raised it by less, and then the savings rate, and then comparing the two. Has one of these dastardly weasels raised their mortgage rate by more than their savings rate? And so it becomes a great game. And this is why we used to publish this big, long table revealing what happened. And one day interest rates will change again and we will pick that idea back up.
I can't wait for that game. It sounds like it's going to be brilliant. You know,
glory
years. I was at a dinner, actually, with a large bank, a very large bank, recently, and we gave the boss of the bank a bit of a grilling over what was going to happen when interest rates rose and whether they were going to raise their savings rates by the full amount, and also what they were going to do about their mortgage rate. And they wouldn't be drawn on it. They said they'd have to, you know, obviously react when it happened. But the point was made that this very large bank had actually raised its standard variable rate about 2 or 3 years ago, citing market conditions. And this was just before funding for lending. And it said it needed to raise it because basically it got more expensive funding on the money markets and stuff. But actually, after that, the price of funding on the money markets absolutely collapsed. And this very large bank never put its standard variable rate back down again.
Weasel.
I was going to say, what did you call them in your article there?
Weasels.
Share Radio has great news. We're going national in March 2016, so you'll be able to hear your favourite programmes on digital across the UK. And to listen on the move, just download one of our latest apps. Our new iPad app includes a fantastic and very fast Listen Again feature. And with our newly upgraded mobile phone app, you can listen live wherever you are. Share Radio is going national on the new D2 digital network in March 2016.
Now, sticking with the Bank of England, and in those minutes, it highlighted the situation with the global oil price. So Brent crude at its lowest level since 2009, dipping below $40. 12 months ago, if you remember back, a barrel cost $65. In June 2014, it was $150. So, Lee, before we talk about the winners in all this, and I'm thinking drivers here, what on earth is going on with the price of oil?
Well, a big factor of this is that the oil-producing countries, they sort of club together and have a bit of a body, and they've refused to cut production. So what's happened is there's been a...
This is OPEC we're talking about.
It is, yes, and it is a glut of oil, basically, that's available. And that's, you know, the main factor of driving it below $40. I mean, there's some talks of it going far lower than that. And that could be devastating to some countries that, you know, rely on oil as a sort of main exporter. But, you know, the main thing is that they've just turned around and said, no, we're going to keep making it.
Why?
It's an interesting...
Squeeze out other competitors?
Yeah, exactly. There's a bit of that, you know. And it's just a really... It's one of those things that really does sort of fluctuate quite massively, as you were just saying there. You think 12 months ago, $65, you know, last June it was $115. I mean, it's almost four times what it is now. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. But of course, petrol prices haven't fallen at the same rate, I'm afraid. But
well, we'll get onto those in a few short moments.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see what happens next year and if they continue to stop doing this.
Well, there was some suggestion from Goldman Sachs that it could go to $20 potentially. Is that likely?
This would be the same Goldman Sachs who I believe predicted it was going to 150 not that long ago.
We'll get it right eventually.
Yeah, I don't know. It could do. It's more about not what it touches, but where it sticks at. And I think nobody expected oil to stick quite at this level. So what's happened this year has been quite interesting. It absolutely tanked at the start of the year. And then it had a bounce back up to about 60, 65. And people decided, oh, right, it will stabilise around 60, 65, which would be reasonable news for a lot of the big oil producers and some of the oil-producing countries, but bad news for some of the US shale oil producers. Still, that, you know, wouldn't be expensive enough at that point. And then it slumped again and has fallen right back down, as Lee pointed out. I mean, you've got to allow for the fact that oil is a commodity that is obviously used around the world, but it's also a commodity that is traded. And I wouldn't underestimate the amount that basically trading pushes a price higher than it should go and lower than it should go for periods of time. But it is this real risk that it sticks, say it sticks at 30, 35, you're going to start to see some real blow-ups in, you know, big companies and big nations.
For every yin, there is a yang, though. Or is that the other way around? I don't know. But the RAC was right, it seems, when they predicted earlier this week that petrol could drop below a quid in time for Christmas. Asda is doing it for 3 days, while Morrison says it aims to hold the price down as long as possible. So, Lee, a festive boost for motorists wanting to drive to their relatives.
Indeed. But can I just say, the RAC have been saying this for absolutely months. So eventually, you know, someone's going to be right. And also, the other thing to remember is that two supermarkets today have dropped prices below £1 a litre. So that's only two. So we're talking Morrison's and Asda. If you don't live near one of those, then, you know, you're not going to get that benefit. I think actually the average at the moment is about 106p per litre. So, I mean, Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's great if you, as I say, if you live by these, but you've got to remember these supermarkets, they do these things as a sort almost like a loss leader type thing. And at the end of the day,
get us into their stores, isn't it?
Asda, for example, it's great that they're offering petrol. You know, they only do it for 3 days. They did it a couple of weeks ago for Black Friday, offering it under £1. It's a great little gimmick, isn't it? Because they expect people to go into store and, you know, buy stuff in store. They're fighting Aldi and Lidl. It's one of the things that they're having to do to try and lure people into their shops. And the thing is, it can't really fall too much further, petrol prices, because you've got to remember, tax on a litre of unleaded is 57.95p per litre, plus 20% VAT. So, you know, 20% on that is
78%
another,
so that's now.
78% if it falls under a pound. That is absolutely... Where's the margins there? We're getting mightily thin.
Absolutely.
So, and that really then does bring into question George Osborne. And ominously, a couple of weeks ago, didn't mention anything about fuel duty freeze in the next budget. So it could be a fuel duty increase next year. If prices are crashing, it's just the whole price of petrol is just going to basically be taxed.
We're talking about the industry. I mean, it's all right for supermarkets to do that, but what about everybody else?
Exactly. And I think that's why... Realistically, I just cannot see a complete average going under £1. You're going to get a couple of supermarkets like this that are going to occasionally go under a pound. Unless tax drops, which is it's just not going to happen. Unless tax drops, I just can't see how it's going to fall any further.
Now let's turn our attention to something completely different, and that's thousands of new family homes could be built on greenbelt land in what would be the biggest shake-up of planning rules for 3 decades. Now, the government's launched a consultation on relaxing the greenbelt rules, specifically for starter homes. Could see a number of towns and cities in Britain set for rather rapid expansion. So, Simon, quickly remind us before we get on to what is a very controversial issue. What exactly is greenbelt when we talk about greenbelt?
Well, the greenbelt is basically a stretch of land around towns and cities. A lot of the greenbelt that gets talked about is the greenbelt around London. Mm. In order to make sure that we don't just get urban sprawl, so that it keeps those green spaces around urban areas. Now, it's a big issue because basically people argue that it's too restrictive and it prevents us building, and that actually we've got plenty of green space, and there's this talk of things like agricultural deserts and things like that, that it's not these green rolling hills that we know and love. Some of it's just a bit scrublandy or just fields that aren't that much use, and that they'd be better off with homes on them. The counterpoint to that is people who say you lift these restrictions and we will just get US style sprawl, and London will start in the centre of London and it will stretch all the way up to Milton Keynes or something.
I imagine a lot of outcry. Is this NIMBYism or is this going to be a good idea, the only solution to this housing crisis we're talking about? Do we have to think of alternative thinking?
We do have to think of alternative thinking, but it has to be done right. And I think possibly this suggestion at the moment is it's not talking about just completely freeing up the green belt. It's about trying to do it in a sensitive way. But we've talked about this a lot on the show before, and I think the big issue is that everybody wants to live in the southeast of the country, everybody wants to build homes in the southeast of the country, and the people who live there don't trust the developers, the government or the local authorities to put the infrastructure in place to support those homes. And until you solve that problem, you are never going to convince all of those people living around London in the Greenbelt that it's a good idea to start building on it.
Lee, your views?
I think we've got the answer. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago I said, Osborne, I want a list of where those 400,000 homes are going to be built.
Yep.
I think we've got a little bit of an indication here. Now, local communities, I think what the onus is an onus on local communities to say, look, we think this bit of land actually is greenbelt, but it's not doing anything, as Simon says, and we should put homes on it. But there has been announcements of where some of these homes are going to go. I thought I'd give you a quick rundown. So, obviously, already announced about Ebbsfleet, big place in Kent, it's going to get lots of new homes there. There's also some going in Barking, Brent Cross and Bicester. They're getting big investments for new homes. And they actually announced this week 50,000 new homes for North Essex and Didcot in Oxfordshire. And also George Osborne's planning advisor, which I think this is going to really get people's backs up, says there needs to be a major expansion of towns and cities such as Guildford, Reading, Norwich and Oxford, which should double in size. Now, that really did get some comments in our section of people just like, how can places like Guildford and the A3, how can that double in size when the infrastructure, unless there's absolutely loads of money spent on infrastructure, it just simply can't happen.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's not just building houses willy-nilly around the country. All that infrastructure.
We touched on this a couple of weeks ago. You know, you need these schools, you need new hospitals, and at a time where things are getting cut back in those sort of services, it's such a fine balance of getting all these things right. It's just so difficult, isn't it? Because we need homes, but we need infrastructure. I wouldn't want to be a planning
minister. You need trains. If you double the size of Guildford, a lot of those people in Guildford are going to be commuting to work. And the trains from Guildford into London are already full. Where are the new trains? Where are the extra, you know, the capacity on the lines? Instead, we're coming up with ideas to make it quicker to get a train to Birmingham.
The consultation says we consider that current policy can hinder locally led development and propose to amend national planning policy so that neighbourhood plans can allocate appropriate small-scale sites in the Greenbelt specifically for starter homes. This is going to be a red tape planning rules nightmare, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but I've got an idea that I've put forward before about what we could do about Greenbelt land building, and it's not going to solve the housing crisis in itself. It's not going to build enough homes, but this is something that happens quite a lot in France, actually. Is I think we should make it easier for people to build their own homes, and basically that we should free up small areas of the Greenbelt around, you know, villages and towns to allow people to have custom-built properties there, sell them plots and get them to build their own homes. Make sure that the design of those homes is sympathetic but also interesting. And if you look at places like France, you see this all the time. I was in France on holiday in October. We were driving down the road and I saw an advert by the side of the road that said, you know, X number of plots for sale, ready to be built in. And what they do is the authorities put in all of the essential services and then they sell off the plots and you can basically go there, build your own home. But it's not like the complete menu of build your own home. Ooh, what shall I do? Grand designs kind of thing here. There tends to be a bit of a format that they follow, and it's not that expensive to do. It's much cheaper to do that than to go buy that home off a developer.
But how many people would have that option realistically?
Well, there's no reason why they shouldn't do. You know, in France, lots of people
get their
own home built.
With lots of space.
It is a big country with lots of space.
Simon.
It is a big country with lots of space. But the argument put forward by people who want to build on the Greenbelt in this country is that actually only a tiny amount of the countryside has been built on. And I think that you would find that local residents would be much more sympathetic to the idea of building if there was this opportunity to build your own home.
But how do you know that people like Fergus and Judith Wilson won't just buy it all up and build another empire? I'm going to move on, but sticking with the housing theme, to buy-to-let tycoons. Fergus and Judith Wilson strike a £250 million deal with Arab investors to sell 900 property Kent Empire. Lee, tell us a little bit more, if you would, about Fergus and Judith, former maths teachers, I believe they were.
So these two are, you know, very much the sort of biggest buy-to-let sort of, a couple have just sort of built up an empire. I mean, to have built up that kind of empire and to have ridden out a financial storm from 2008 onwards, it's been no small feat. So they started up buy-to-let business 30 years ago and just slowly started buying up properties in Kent, Ashford and places, Maidstone, and just renting them out. And basically last year, I think, you know, they're well into their 60s now, and I think they just wanted to get rid of it. But I think they wanted to get rid of it, but in one block. They didn't want to start selling them off individually. So they've had these properties. They had 1,000. They sold off 100 of them in the summer to some Chinese and Indian investors, and then the rest of this block are going to be sold to Arab investors. Now, what they're saying is that the people that are living in these homes, the tenants, nothing's going to change. You know, they're not going to get kicked out. But they are larger-than-life characters, especially Fergus. I mean, he's been quite controversial in the past.
Yeah.
At one
convicted
point,
convicted of attacking an estate agent following a dispute about a boiler.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one incident. That happened. Another was when he just sent out 200 eviction notices. And I think he
for tenants on housing benefits, should point out.
Yeah, because he'd rather had Polish people move in. That's what he's saying, because they were better payers.
I remember that.
That was all, you know, so he's been very outspoken over the years, you know, being featured in numerous stories, and they're finally getting out, and I'm guessing to set sail and enjoy a very big retirement.
I imagine so as well. They, interestingly, were beneficiaries of the interest rates being slashed in 2008. It said they were said to be on the brink of financial ruin after the bank stopped lending in the credit crunch. However, they were saved when the Bank of England slashed interest rates and held them at a historic low. So we talked about the winners and losers. But have they got out at the right time, Simon? Because we're talking a lot about how much of a hammering buy-to-lets got.
Well, I think that probably there is an element. So one of the reasons why there was this talk that they might be in trouble after the financial crisis is because all these properties were mortgaged. And I think actually Fergus Wilson has said in an interview that he couldn't have done now what he did then because they were borrowing at, you know, at least 75% loan to value. So they built up this property empire worth millions of pounds. Except actually they also owed millions of pounds to the bank to fund it. And so when those house prices slipped, they suddenly found their equity decreasing and they could have been in trouble. Now, fortunately, we pointed out winners and losers. Someone cut the interest rate down to 0.5% and one of the biggest winners was the Wilsons. As to whether, you know, they would be massively hit by what's going on now, well, they wouldn't be hit by the stamp duty thing unless they were going to buy more properties. Certainly, if they do have a lot of mortgage debt, they could get hit by the income tax relief. You're going to lose the mortgage interest relief. But I would imagine they probably hold these companies through these properties through a company. So actually, they would probably still be able to benefit from offsetting their mortgage interest against their tax bill. I think it's more just they've decided they've had enough and they want to cash in. The difficulty is, though, like if you're a big fund manager and you hold a lot of shares in one company, it's very difficult to suddenly sell that much stuff into a market without completely saturating it and driving down the price of what you're selling. So, you know, they seem to have struck this deal with these investors and, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Do we know anything more about these Arab investors and what they plan on doing with those 900 properties we're talking about?
There hasn't been any sort of finer details about who is behind it. But as I was saying before, all they're saying, and it's just a promise from the Wilsons, I guess, that, you know, the people that are in these properties are not going to be suddenly kicked out. And I'm going to guess these investors are going to want tenants in them. I don't think they're going to, you know, they can't just flip them. I mean,
no, they're investing for the yield. They're investing for the rental return on it. It's this hunt for yield. In a low interest rate world, basically, these properties are probably yielding maybe 5-6%. And so that looks very attractive.
And house prices in Kent in the last 12 months, as most of the South East, especially commuter belt, have gone up substantially. So they're up 8% in the last 12 months. So, you know, I suppose some of coming, you know, Arab investors are looking at what's sort of stable and what's, you know, a good long-term investment, and property in the southeast very much in the forefront of many foreign investors' minds at the moment.
They're down there, and also we're talking about all these new homes and Ebbsfleet and things like that, aren't we? But that area of Kent's getting a lot of money ploughed into it, isn't it? I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. He does have one tip though. Don't buy on a floodplain. We're going to turn our attention to energy. It's not good news for Cooperative Energy. They attracted the most customer complaints ever recorded by Citizens Advice in its quarterly rankings of the best and worst suppliers. It received almost 1,600 complaints per 100,000 customers between July and September, 40 times more than the best performer SSE. It comes, though, as its thoughts households have overpaid £6.5 billion on energy bills in the last 12 months. A price comparison site claims that an average of £318 per customer is overpaid. EnergyHelpline.com blames a lack of understanding around switching supplier, with a quarter of households having never done so. So would stuffing my freezer with old newspapers cut my energy bills? We'll see. But first, here's personal finance expert Ed Bauscher.
It is huge, and don't forget, some customers, if they've never switched, they're not paying by direct debit, they could be potentially able to get annual savings of more than £400 a year if they're a family living in a sort of slightly larger than average home. So the potential savings here are massive. So it is well worth switching if you've never done it before. And, you know, we've said it before, it's relatively easy to do. You can start on one of the price comparison websites. They'll take you through the process. It'll take 2 to 3 weeks, and there's no danger at all of you being cut off from your gas and electricity. That's the crucial point here. You know, there's more scope for things to go wrong when you switch bank accounts, although it's much better than it used to be. But actually, with energy, it really should be fine. It should be a pretty much a painless process.
So that's personal finance expert Ed Bauscher there talking to us about the painless process of switching your energy supply. So Lee, firstly, cooperative energy. Why so bad? I understand it's something about a computer system upgrade, but why do we always see this with companies when their computer systems...
Yeah, so Sisters Advice research, or what, you know, this data attracted the most complaints ever by the Sisters Advice, which is no mean feat looking at some of these firms that, you know, provide services. But indeed, they upgraded their systems in March, and it's just created a complete meltdown of customer service. And it's not the first time this has happened for an energy supplier. We look at someone like Empower. I mean, that has been dogged with IT issues.
It's
after
mostly around bills, isn't it?
It is. And I guess energy bills are quite a complicated and complex thing to sort of calculate. And they go into these new systems, and I think, wait a minute, haven't you really tested these systems out? Because all that's going to happen, people are going to get confused, they're going to flood your customer services complaint department, and you're going to get loads of complaints about you. So, you know, and it just does not reflect well, and it will just make people want to switch. And energy is one of those things that people tend to switch more than other sort of services and utilities, more so recently, and there's a lot of, you know, newer, smaller companies coming out. But it's quite unusual, actually, for it not to be one of the big boys to be topping the complaint league. So well done, cooperative.
Well, you said it might encourage people to switch. Surely that's a good thing as well. Overpaying by $6.5 billion.
That's a lot of money.
I mean, obviously.
You just need to use, you know, something like we've got on our website. It's so simple to use. You just enter a few details. It will tell you what the best tariff is for you, and you should be switched and changing energy supply, you know, in no time.
Now, Lee, before we move on, you got a query from a reader related to cutting the cost of their energy bill. A rather unusual idea of stuffing your freezer with old newspapers could perhaps help you save a few quid. Being the ever intrepid investigative reporters that you are, you went away, you found the answer, and what did you come up with?
The answer is no.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I mean, a freezer's for food, right? Maybe you want to put newspaper in it. But if you, no, the argument is that there's gaps in the freezer, and when you're opening it up, you know, it lets more of the coldness out, and it takes more time for the freezer to then get back to its, you know, temperature. What a lot of people were just saying in the comments on it, why not just fill it up with like frozen bread, you know, put bread in there and freeze bread, and that can like plug the gaps and whatnot. So, yeah, I don't think it's a particularly good energy saving tip.
Interestingly, the answer was both yes and no. So the answer was yes, if you were to fill your freezer with newspaper, you would save on energy due to the sort of the gaps. But no, in practice, you wouldn't save any energy, because then when you open the freezer to get anything out, you would find that you'd stuffed your freezer full of newspaper and would therefore be unable to find the food. You would then have the door open for longer, thereby losing more cold and allowing more warm in. So in theory, yes. In practice, no.
You do, though, suggest that regularly defrosting the freezer will help cut energy bills. And if you buy a new one, always check it has a high efficiency rating. Fantastic. Now, Simon, performing fund managers of the year have been revealed. The best and the worst, the winners and the losers. Sort the wheat from the chaff, will you? Go.
Well, investment management company Tilney Best Invest highlights the 100 investment managers to help sort that wheat from that chaff. And basically, they have revealed the top managers. And there are some winners and losers here. Some people have risen up the ranking. Some people have fallen down the ranking. And I think that what this highlights is the difficulty in picking a good fund manager, and also the difficulty in relying on some of the reports that get put out about this. So arguably, what you want in a fund manager is someone who is good enough that they are a reason why you shouldn't just choose a tracker fund. Because a tracker fund will simply follow the market. It won't try and beat the market. That means you're not going to do better than it. But it also means that you aren't going to do worse. And one of the great risks of picking a fund manager is actually they have a bad year and you do worse. And also there is the risk that you fund managers tend to specialise in a certain area and that you choose the wrong area. Whereas if you choose the broadest possible tracker fund, you like a global tracker fund, you're essentially invested in a bit of everything in the world. So, and you just rely on long-term growth to do the work for you. But some of these managers, you know, have managed to fall. The Aberdeen Asian Equities team sank from 12th place to 91st. I mean, that's a big drop. So are we saying that over the last year, that team has got that much worse? Or is it just that Asian equities haven't really done that well over the year? So, and that's why they've tumbled. And it's actually, it's the latter one. So I think you need to be a bit careful with some of these things and take it with a pinch of salt. But there are some managers named here who are probably a good example of managers with a long-term track record who probably are worth paying the extra money above a tracker fund for. So in top spot, we've got Angus Tullock of First State Investments. He is head of the Asia-Pacific equities team at Stewart Investors, which is what First State Investments was renamed as. He's got a long history of doing very well, knowing a lot about Asia and beating the markets and picking his way through tricky markets there. You've then got a guy called Giles Hargreave, who works for Hargreave Hale, and he runs a couple of funds under the name Marlborough, and he specialises in smaller companies, and in some cases, very, very small companies indeed. And again, this is an example of an investing sphere where having a good manager can really pay off, because he will be looking at those small companies and picking out the ones that he thinks will do really well. And that's a lot harder to do with small companies than it is, for example, in the FTSE 100, where everyone knows a lot about those big companies. Another name in here is a guy called Mark Slater, the son of a very famous investor who died recently, Jim Slater. Mark, you know, he focuses on a specific kind of company, growth at a reasonable price. So he's looking for small companies that can grow but aren't expensive. He's done very well. And we've got the closest thing that we have to a household name in investing in this country, Neil Woodford.
Another big fan of Rolls Royce recently, I hear.
Yeah, he has. And I think he's the kind of guy who does have a very, very long-term track record that proves that he is worth paying for.
He's got a good team behind him as well, hasn't he?
Well, exactly, yeah. And so this is the thing, is you've got to remember that there's an awful lot of investment funds out there, and an awful lot of them are just plain old average. And they don't buy a plain old average one. If you're going to pay for a fund manager, make sure they're a good one.
We're going to stick with investing for our final story. Something a little bit different, though. What about investing in whiskey? Yes, it's a thing, of course. Apparently, a 100-year-old bottle of Laphroaig, I assume that's how you say it, would sell for £6,000 at auction. Here's Rupert Patrick, the CEO of Whiskey Invest Direct, talking about their whiskey investing platform.
We've bought around about £4 million worth of whiskey, and we've bought from Diageo, we bought from Beam Suntory. We've got more that I'm not going to tell you what they are, but they're coming onto our website in about 2 to 3 weeks' time. So the plan is really to be working with a whole industry. Now, nobody has to work with us, but we're just giving them an opportunity to put some of their whiskey onto the trading exchange. So it's tradable to investors and to the trade 24/7.
So that was Rupert Patrick talking there about a 100-year-old bottle of single malt. So investing in whiskey, good or bad idea?
Drinking whiskey is probably a better idea, so. I reckon.
Lee?
Well, as long as you're willing to accept the risks, you know, this is
not drinking whiskey.
No,
all right.
I've been investing in whiskey. as long as you know it's going to be a risky thing to do, and it's a bit of a hobby on the side, I don't see it being a problem.
So what you're doing is basically you're investing in something on the basis that it is scarce.
Mm-hmm.
Whiskey doesn't actually do anything apart from obviously you can drink it and enjoy it, but £6,000 worth of enjoyment and drinking? No, probably not. It's probably not that much better than the cheaper bottle. And none of these whiskies are getting drunk. They're just getting bought and traded. And so what you've got to look at this is like gold or classic cars or something like that. You're investing in scarcity, and those markets have a tendency to suddenly turn, and really, when they fall hard.
Yeah, and actually, another thing with whiskey as well, you've got to remember how big a market there is in somewhere like China. So actually, people in China are probably starting to invest in whiskey a little bit more now because they're interested in it, and it's a kind of asset that you can hold on to. It's something physically that you can, like, you know, if you've got a wash with cash, you can go and put yourself a little whiskey cellar, you know, in your home. So, you know, you can see with these rare bottles, a bit like wine, you know, some of these wine collections go for a lot of money. If you know what you're doing and you do the right research, you know, you could potentially make a bob or two, but just don't make
if
it.
All else fails,
don't put all your eggs in one
basket. Still got a bottle of whiskey to celebrate or commiserate.
Exactly.
Either way. Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, Editor Simon Lambert, thank you so much for joining us.